you've heard the prediction that artificial intelligence will eliminate millions of white-collar jobs. So how worried should you be? And what can you do to make yourself more valuable in the workplace? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about all of this are Jeff Schaefer, Director of AI Strategy at the University of Cincinnati, and Matt Call, an Associate Professor of Management at Texas A&M University. Thank you both for being here today. So by now, a lot of us have tried AI at some point. We might have said, this isn't very good, it gets stuff wrong. But what are we missing? Jeff, get us up to speed about where AI is right now. How good has it become?
It gets better every day. And so often I hear people who say, I've tried a tool and it didn't work, or gave me a bad output, or it hallucinates, or something like that. And I think we have to realize in the context, there's a saying that the worst AI you're using is today. And tomorrow it's going to be completely different. I've gotten out of the habit of saying, you know, I can't do that with AI, because on Tuesday there'll be something new and all of a sudden it can do that. So the first thing to understand is it moves really, really fast, which then means you have to be on top of it as to what it is good at the moment and what it still maybe struggles with. I would say that naturally, doing anything that is content related, whether that's writing or now audio, video, the generative portion of that, generating content, is really where it excels. And the thing that's probably taken off the most in the last 12 months is the coding. It's just gotten really, really good at coding, where it just wasn't really good at that a few years back. And so that's probably the biggest change we've seen here recently.
So, Jeff, a lot of us seem to have this knowledge gap between where we think AI is and where it actually is, because it's getting so much better every day. Is that dangerous for us in terms of, you know, our job security?
I would say yes, to some extent. I mean, we do have to put into a category of, you know, what your job is. So I think you're probably safe if you are a doctor, a nurse, a plumber, an electrician. The trades and healthcare are probably, you know, doing really well right now. But if your job is sitting at a computer screen and specifically doing the same thing over and over and over again, and it can be a higher level cognitive task like computer programming, data and analytics, software development, I think are going to be ones that really get hit. And we're already seeing it. There's a great page that Indeed keeps track of these job sectors, and they benchmark it to the February before COVID. And if we look at those job sectors, you know, at the bottom of the list right now, about 60% where it was pre-COVID is software development and data analytics, and even marketing is down there. Things like veterinarian and dental and pharmacy and therapy and physicians, they're all at the top of the list. And so those jobs have been growing. So the short answer is yes, it will impact jobs. Depends on the job you're in, I think, is what we have to talk about. How is it going to impact your job? And then what can you do in that job sector? If you're a computer programmer, what does that job look like?
Well, let's talk about how big the impact could be. One CEO in the AI industry has predicted AI will eliminate 50% of entry-level white-collar jobs within 1 to 5 years. Of course, we've seen job eliminations with other innovations in the past. Matt, what do you think that will mean for these displaced workers? Where will they go?
I think it's a really good question. And it's not so much whether or not they will be replaced. I am of the belief now that they will. The question is how fast, and can we, you know, as a collective, find ways to retrain and, you know, find places for people to work if it happens that fast? You look back at the Industrial Revolution or globalization, which took, you know, a lot of the manufacturing out of our country. Those transitions happened at, you know, 100 years and 50 years, respectively. If something happens in 5 years, then you're going to have a lot more adverse impact on kind of your average workers. And as Jeffrey said, certain places will see it first. And computer programming is a place that is just largely 3-5 years ago, this was a growing field. That's why it's such a stark example. Now it is a place that is largely automated. Cloud code was just so accurate. So the CEO you mentioned who said that is of Anthropic, who makes Claude and Cloud code. He put out a very interesting editorial, 10,000 word kind of essay of what he believes is going to happen. I am of the belief that there is a tsunami coming, but I do not know precisely who is going to lose their jobs. But I do think we need to start, you know, as a society, start having conversations about it, because what I am comfortable predicting is that there are going to be a few winners and a lot of losers in the economic shakeup.
What do you think, Jeff? Is there a place where workers who are displaced by AI should be thinking about going? Or do you, can we even tell what the safe spots are?
I think, boy, those comments that Matt had are spot on there. I would say, let's talk about computer programming for a second. I just was on a call earlier today with somebody who was asking me about getting some help with trying to build a dashboard for public safety or whatnot. I pulled up Claude Code. We were on a little screen share. I pulled up Claude Code. I gave it a little CSV file. And in 3 minutes, I had a working dashboard that was interactive based on this data file. And the person was speechless. They were thinking that what he was trying to do was going to take, you know, weeks or months of development. This is not a coder by trade. And now he feels like I'm empowered to just go get in Claude Code and solve my problem. That's what we're talking about. Now, if you get to enterprise application, I'm going to say we're a long ways away from enterprise application getting completely automated. If I could take 30 seconds, I'll speak to the top of these organizations and say, we have to be careful of laying off all these software programmers because the data is trained on humans. I just think about that for a second. If you get rid of all the low wage workers, you know, the entry level positions, well, where do the mid level and upper level positions come from? They come in our organization from moving up the corporate ladder. And the reason Claude Code codes so well is because of training on decades of really good programming. Programming language from human beings. That might mean that we're not doing software development in the traditional sense. It may mean that maybe a software developer becomes a Claude coding trainer, right? It trains Claude, it reviews Claude, it assists Claude, it reinforces Claude. And so we might see a shift in those positions. But I do agree at the end of the day, there's going to be many, many more affected by it than not.
This reminds me of Willy Wonka, where the kid's father is displaced at the toothpaste factory by a robot, and then he gets a job fixing the robot. But I mean, there aren't going to be enough AI fixers or trainer jobs to replace all these that go away, are there?
Well, and I also add to that, the danger that may not be obvious is, okay, if we do displace 50% of entry-level workers, and the counter to what Jeff is saying is you probably could have these kind of more seasoned workers to train the models. But then when you get rid of all your people, you're really reliant on the companies who are currently not running profits because they're basically, you know, running off of investments based on potential. And so what that means is they'll raise prices, right? So right now, while the language models at the enterprise level are being trained and we're slowly displacing workers, then when you have no workers, which is a resource that takes years and decades to build, right? If you got rid of that, what kind of leverage do these companies have? And it's not like we have 50 different, you know, AI companies that are all competing for enterprise business. It's like 3 or 4. And so this is how Amazon put Borders books out of, made it so we used to go and, you know, try shoes on, and then we bought them on Zappos, and then, you know, all the shoe stores go out of business, and then Zappos can raise their price, or Amazon can raise their price. And so again, my point is there is kind of a bargaining that happens at this kind of collective level that people need to strategically think through what all these moves might look like.
We're talking in this recorded interview about AI in the workplace and what it could mean for the future of many white-collar jobs. Matt, I read an argument that you wrote that will AI take my job isn't necessarily the right question to be asking. What do you think employees should be asking instead?
So this gets to Jeff's point where it's humans that need to train AI. At the enterprise level, what I really tried to talk about in this Wall Street Journal piece was kind of the how. How are people going to be displaced over time? And ironically, it's going to be that we all train the enterprise level AI. Really, what I outline in detail is this idea that, you know, when we have AI that's embedded in all of our workflows, you know, you can say like Copilot is embedded in all of our Microsoft products, it's able to calculate at a granular level all of our activities, everything from the way we are tone in an email to a customer that convinces them to keep our subscription, or what type of networks we have, who we're talking to get what done. all of that in the past was knowledge that was really housed inside the brains of people. And so we were able to take that with us if we decided to leave the organization, and that made it so we had bargaining power to you know, remain at a competitive wage. Well, if all of that, you know, slowly but surely gets transferred to the enterprise level, that I call it like the firm level brain, then eventually it doesn't need us anymore, right? And so essentially what I'm saying is companies and people are not really talking about this idea of intellectual property ownership, IP ownership, and whether or not when I do my work within the enterprise, you know, AI, are they just going to be able to own that going forward such that they can not hire, you know, more people like me, or when I, you know, when I quit, you know, they don't hire after, or they don't essentially don't need me, or, you know, in the long term. But one of the things I argue in that piece is that, you know, another way to at least in the short term combat this is to, well, first of all, recognize, have conversations about the privacy disclosures and about IP and how that is owned with your companies. And from a governance perspective, start talking about that more. But two, what I argue is people should have a personal AI that they use and are building so that they can actually have a personalized, unique brain of all your expertise. And so in the very beginning of this, you noted, you know, AI is not, some people are finding it not to be really effective. Well, I would argue it's not effective when you don't invest in it. So what I mean by that is when I use AI, you're able to put all of your knowledge base into it, and then it becomes much more smart. And so I would argue that the more expertise you have, the more AI actually helps you, and you're able to get better outputs because you are training it. So my point is there are limits. You cannot put, you know, company data into personal AI tools, and you have to be very careful about that. You don't want to do the wrong thing by your company. But I know people who find ways to use their strategic thinking and kind of the things that are unique to them, do that in personal AI, and then do what needs to be done in the enterprise AI. So again, trying to think about and surface this idea that how people will be displaced is us kind of yielding our IP at a kind of in a collective process of working in enterprise systems.
So the idea is if you're using your own personally licensed, or the AI that you pay for personally, that you use personally, and you're putting all your knowledge and experience into that, then you're not necessarily feeding it into the company AI that the company uses as a whole. Jeff, what's your take on that?
I agree in part to some of what Matt just said. Certainly, the models do get better training on your information. It knows how, you know, it knows what I'm looking for, and it will respond in ways I'm looking for because I've kind of trained it myself to do that, right? I can even give it what we call system level prompts that will tell it how to respond. You know, I like bullet points, and don't give me 16 pages of text. So I do agree there. I do agree on training people up and doing that. I just think the difficulty here with the premise, I mean, and Matt hit on it, you can't use your personal ChatGPT or Claude account in a company. It's just not going to be allowed. I work with very large organizations, and they have enterprise software. And if you're going to use their systems, I mean, some of these, the large banks I use, those sites are blocked. You can't even get to your personal Gmail account. So you're going to be forced into those environments. If you're not forced in those environments, don't diminish what Matt hit on it. Like, don't put company proprietary anything in there. You're going to be fired the next day because they're going to be monitoring these prompts. So be very, very careful about that. But I do agree that, you know, from a standpoint of, I use all these tools. I have a personal Claude, a personal ChatGPT. I use them all. But, you know, that's my business. That's what I do, right? I think it's good for people to know how to use those tools. That's going to give them an edge up, know what they can accomplish and make them better. And I think that will help them. And that knowledge does transfer, right? If I'm really good at automating a workflow with AI, well, I can do that with any company, right? I can say, hey, I solved this problem over here. You know, the flip side is just the IP becomes a difficult conversation. And that's nothing new, by the way. If I work for a paint company and I come up with a formula to, you know, make paint dry faster or something like that, that's owned by the company. That's not owned by me. I might have my name on the patent, but I don't own that IP. I agree in part with that. I probably echo more of the, you may be in a situation where you can't. So maybe you got to go home and do that on the side, or maybe you just have to, you know, incorporate that in your daily life if you can't get it into your work life.
So I also agree with what Jeff is saying here. And two things. One, I said in the short term, that helps because using your personal AI is also training these language models, right? So they are learning from you. So it's not, so they are also basically taking your IP. The other thing I would argue is that, so here's an example, Jeff, of somebody I know who does work at a big energy company who I talked to. They said that they make all of their decisions and only use data that is for their company in their enterprise system. But when it comes to thinking through, when it comes to having a thought partner, he even generates fake data that is not the same as the company data and puts it in there to actually simulate the way that he would think through. And so strategically, kind of the secret sauce of what he does is actually done in the personal AI. There is nothing about company sensitive information in there. And then he will work in that. So again, trying to work around that. If this does happen in 5 years, I would argue that a sector that has never really been unionized and even has frowned upon unionization because of the stance of kind of where white collar work has usually been, I think that there is really no other solution beyond some sort of collective bargaining around this idea of IP. Now, the example of coming up with a paint, I understand that those are kind of explicit things that you know generally happen. But when we're talking, you know, thousands of little data points that are modeling behaviors and kind of almost tacit knowledge bases over millions of data points, I don't think that we have a real legal precedent for kind of IP ownership in that way. And I don't know that one employee can say, hey, I'm not going to work in your enterprise AI. I do believe it's a problem of collective action that, and it's also in a sector that has traditionally never even thought about collective organizing. And so it's an interesting time. I'm curious if it will go that way.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting tool, by the way. I call that masking data or, you know, putting data, let's say you got a customer list or something that's proprietary, strip the names off of it, put a unique right. identifier on it and toss it in the tool. That's a great technique. I use that all the time. I also would mention, you know, we haven't really talked about that one of the big factors that I think will help in all of this is open source. Meta leads that, but we can do quite a bit. I see companies who don't want to even send their data, you know, through these enterprise security like Microsoft Copilot or something like that. I was working on a large, you know, health data project, you know, where the data is HIPAA and, you know, medical records. And all that was done with open source software. And so what that means is the model isn't training on it. It's running on a laptop. It's running on a server in your own environment. You have complete control of it. And even for a person, it sounds like, oh, you got to be an enterprise to do that. I have a gaming laptop. I can spin up a language model on my laptop, turn off my internet connection. Nobody knows what I'm asking that model. Nobody can see it. Nothing's trained on it. And it can still help me in a personal sense. So I think we'll see more of that in the future as well, which is probably a good thing.
I wonder what you both think. You both work at universities. What are the implications about this for education? If young people don't learn how to write, shouldn't people know how to do that themselves before an AI kind of takes that over for them?
I think it's a really important question that, again, these are societal implications we need to talk about. And so I'll tackle this idea of K through 12 first. I think that AI will either, it can do two things. One, it can accelerate learning, but it can also make people dumb. And what I mean by that is they are not going to do the mental work that actually gets them the knowledge and human capital that's going to help them thrive. And people could say, so counter to your point there, people could say, oh, well, AI is just going to write them that. Well, I think there's something that happens when we have to learn to write that just changes our brain and it impacts everything much more than just writing, right? This is thinking. I think if AI used correctly can accelerate learning. You know, in education, we know the best form of education is one-on-one tutoring. You know, if you look at all of the data, it would suggest that if you have a tutor who can sit with you and outline your specific places for growth, give you tailored advice on what to do differently, you will learn, it will accelerate your learning. And I currently think that AI can do that at scale. So I built a GPT for my son. He's in college level calculus right now. And I built a GPT that's false. It doesn't access the internet. You know, teach him in plain English how to do calculus. And he puts in problems, he asks questions, and it literally acts as a tutor. It doesn't give him the answer, but it accelerates his learning because it is able to diagnose where he's going wrong, what he's not understanding, and then explain it in plain English. So I do think the government needs to get serious about AI because people will use it and they will not think and they will become dumber, or they could use it in a really productive way and scale tutoring.
For the K through 12, where do these students have space to even learn to write if AI is there to help them as a tutor? And I guess you're saying what you developed for your son isn't connected to the internet, but for these large language models, as I understand it, they learn how to write from copying other writers. They're learning, they'll write in a style, they'll suggest things because they've sucked up all this information, all the work that humans have done. So how do kids learn to come up with their own ideas, their own style?
So I would just argue that it's probably not a skill that's going to be that much differentiated, because in the future, AI will do most of the writing. But what we do need to understand and care about are the underlying critical thinking skills that lead to delivering a concise message, right? And so whether it's through grammar or writing, maybe those are actually obsolete. But what we do need to figure out is that maybe a high enough level of abstraction is put guardrails on the AI early on that make people go through the steps to actually develop that critical thinking. I think AI will be embedded enough that we probably won't have to learn grammar, but we do need to learn thinking. Because that will, AI cannot really replace that, or at least I don't think it should replace that, because I think that's a bigger societal problem.
So just very briefly, for both of you, what would your message be for young people who are entering college or even students in the middle of their studies? Is it possible to even predict what the job market will look like?
If the job is working with your hands, I believe it will last. You'll have more of a future at this point. So I think the trades are going to be important. I think it's going to be important for, and I would even argue that doctors, you know, if they're using their hands, yes, but those who are just diagnosing, that is going to change. The professions are all going to change. And so, but bottom line, what I tell my kids is, and what I focus on with my kids is using it to accelerate learning, not replace it. Focusing on things like empathy, social skills, critical thinking. That is, we have to have a renaissance in that. And honestly, I think because AI is going to lead to a lot of people doing less thinking, I feel like people will shine if they learn to use AI correctly to help accelerate their learning. And so that's what I would tell my kids is learn how to look people in the eye, learn how to build relationships in person, learn how to be good conversationalists, to critically think, and then let AI teach you a bunch of stuff really fast at your fingertips, because you can, right? So I think really it's going to be bimodal. There's going to be people who really outperform in the future, and there's going to be people who get left behind because I don't want to say laziness, but or just the system fails to give them proper guardrails in their education around AI.
But here's what it could also do. There's a somebody in high school right now, or somebody, you know, an undergrad in college who's listening to this. Think about that idea you always wanted to start that business. You know, if you were doing that 10 years ago, having the ability to, okay, now I got to build a website. I don't know how to do that. I got to code this application. I don't know how to do that. I have to build a marketing plan. I don't know how to do that. Right now, leverage the superpower of these things, and you could probably build something very, very quickly. You could have a website spun up in a few minutes. You could have an application done in a day, and you could explore these things that maybe you never had the opportunity to explore or didn't have the time. And I think that could be part of the renaissance, right? We can do more interesting things, right? We can put power in the hands of people who didn't otherwise have that power.
Oh, true. Yeah, love it.
Well, I have been talking with Jeff Schaefer, Director of AI Strategy at the University of Cincinnati, and Matt Call, an Associate Professor of Management at Texas A&M University. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Up next, how to deal with your rising utility bills. This is Cincinnati Edition.